A nation cannot survive without a memory of its past, and the leading depository of the record of the American past is the Library of Congress. This month we celebrate the 200th birthday of the nation's largest library, the Library of Congress. The depository is some of America's greatest literary achievements, valuable historical records, and much more. Talking History's Dennis Mihalik will speak with James Conaway, the author of A New History of the Library of Congress.
Thank you, Brian. Welcome, Mr. Conaway.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the obvious. I mean, why did Congress want or need a library?
Well, Congress is concerned with passing laws, and in the best of all worlds, laws are passed based upon fact, not just politics. And I think early on, the Continental Congress determined that they needed some sort of reference books to be able to go to when they needed facts. And the Library of Congress, before it was formally established, actually goes back to a collection of books of various sorts, just a very small collection that was used for reference.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, where was it located?
Well, it was first in New York City, but it didn't exist as the Library of Congress at the time. That's when the Congress first met, or the provisional government met, and then, of course, moved to Philadelphia, which was the first site of Congress. And their collection of books grew there as well, but it wasn't an official entity. It wasn't until the Congress was established in Washington, D.C., that the attention turned to a serious library, meaning one that had extensive capability for providing facts and figures for members of Congress. And the idea that the library should be something more than this was Thomas Jefferson's, of course. And once Jefferson, who was, as we all know, a great scholar and man of words, got hold of the idea, it began to be something else entirely. And that, to me, was always the interesting part of the story, because Jefferson, the ghost of Jefferson, the reality and the ghost of Jefferson moves in and out of the creation of the Library of Congress, and still, to this day, informs what the library is.
Okay, well, let's deal with the reality of it then. I mean, during the War of 1812, just after Jefferson's presidency, the British sacked the United States Capitol. Did that damage the library?
Certainly did. But if I could, Dennis, let me back up just a little bit here. When the library was formally established in 1800, and Jefferson pushed for buying books in England and abroad as well as in this country, because in 1800 the availability of good, extensive libraries was quite limited. Even in that day, some members of Congress objected to spending any money at all on books, and the usual kind of objections were raised that have sort of echoed through the years. But Jefferson persisted. The library was founded. It was housed in Congress between the two houses, between the House and the Senate, and it served there as a source of information for staff and also for congressmen and senators. Okay. At this time, it was a fairly limited library, but by the standards of a young nation, it was not limited. It was big. It occupied one very large room that had balconies and ways of walking around it, and was considered quite an attraction, kind of a tourist attraction. People came to look at it. All right, then during the invasion of 1812, as you know, the British came up from the Chesapeake and invaded the city and burned Congress, in part in retaliation for American troops burning a building, a congressional building, or a government building in Canada earlier. And when they burned the Capitol, they severely damaged the library, and in fact destroyed most of the works that were in it. So that, after all the all the problems that had existed establishing the library in the first place and bringing this collection together, this small triumph of the library was destroyed. An interesting thing had happened, though, in the interim. Jefferson had retired, had gone back to Monticello. He was he had had a very hard political career. He still had enemies in Congress and outside of Congress, and he was also very close to being bankrupt because he had extravagant habits, as you know, with regard to architecture and other things. He spent a lot of money on changing Monticello and other things, experiments, whatever, and he just didn't have that money, and he had a lot of debts. But what he also had at Monticello was a wonderful library, the best library that existed in the United States, his personal library to which he had contributed all of his life, starting from the time he was a student, when he was an ambassador to France and so on, while he was the president. And the proposal was made to restart, to jumpstart the Library of Congress, so to speak, that Congress in the United States should purchase this very extensive, very good, very expensive by the standards then library to be the basis of an ongoing, growing Library of Congress. The beauty of that, from the point of view of anyone who loves Thomas Jefferson and the idea of him, is that it was able, his books were, if this was okayed by Congress, this library, this wonderful library, would pass to posterity, American posterity, and would not be broken up after his death, which undoubtedly would have happened. And also, the Congress, and could be the instrument of the American people, their tax monies, whatever, would go to help an old man who needed financial help desperately in his final years. So as you can imagine, his enemies tried to prevent this, but his friends were for it, and eventually it passed. And his library was purchased, and he received enough money to pay off most of his debts and to live a comfortable old age until he died. And those books were transported from Monticello to Washington, D.C., in wagons. He had cases specially built. I wish those had survived that held the books. They were loaded onto wagons. This whole wagon train came up with the books, thousands of volumes from Monticello, and they had to ford several rivers in these wagons to get the books to the library, to Washington, D.C., so it was quite an event, quite a dramatic passage. And it all had a wonderful effect.
Now, these cases, I mean, did he make waterproof cases?
No, they weren't waterproof
cases. They weren't?
Cases.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the wagons weren't floating in the rivers, but
right.
My point is that these are small rivers in Virginia, mm-hmm. Piedmont, but they still had to go through water. You know, it was a rough journey over rough roads, and he had these cases, these wooden cases specially made at Monticello just for the passage, just for transporting these books. And it was an ordeal and a kind of an event. And when they arrived here, they went into the back into the refurbished Library of Congress, which was still in the Capitol building itself, where it remained for years. But during the administration of Ainsworth Rand Spofford, who was one of the librarians of Congress, probably the most renowned librarian of Congress, certainly of the early ones, he was constantly pushing for a new building because they didn't have room for these books at this point. They had Jefferson's library, plus they had everything else that they had accumulated, and books soon overwhelmed this very large gallery in the Capitol and had to be stacked on the floor. And Spofford he complained about this and pushed and pushed and pushed for a separate building to be built. And finally, congressmen, senators, and their aides were having so much trouble getting around these piles of books and finding what they needed to find that they okayed the expenditure of money to build what is now known as the Library of Congress. It's the one we all know that's just there, just east of the Capitol, on the corner It's called the Jefferson Building. It's one of three buildings of the official Library of Congress today, but it's the ornate, the beautiful building built with classical design, classical proportions that we all know of as the Library of Congress. And it was appropriately named after Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say the ghost of Jefferson. How is Jefferson's ghost out there still influencing the Library of Congress?
Well, I meant that in the sense that his whole idea of knowledge was not something that was static. It was not just facts and figures. It contained elements of the American imagination, all imagination. It was limitless. This notion that he said at one point that there was no subject imaginable that a member of Congress might not someday need to have knowledge of. And by expanding on this idea and taking this idea to its logical conclusion, the library became not just a warehouse, not just a storage bin, but an institution that was devoted to human thought, to the human imagination, whatever the ramifications of that might be. And it is that notion that led the library to begin to collect everything that people there felt was important. Obviously, American intelligence, American imagination, American works are clearly in the forefront, but it really is an institution that embraces all knowledge, as indeed Thomas Jefferson did.
Mm-hmm. Now, we also know Jefferson as a founder of the American democracy, and of course, at least in my mind as a scholar, I think of the Library of Congress not as a library for Congress, but as a national library. Did Jefferson have this idea?
I think in the sense that it embodied the best of American thought, he did. I think he also saw it as a point of origin of information and a resource for all the people. Whether or not Thomas Jefferson ever envisioned that the library would be what it is today, I can't say. But you're right, it is America's library. And it surprises some people, many people who use it, actually, that its genesis lay in the needs of Congress and that it was totally dependent upon Congress for its existence, still is for that matter, although it has taken on a life of its own now. But in the early days, there were some people in Congress who thought the library was a waste of time, that they could get whatever they needed out of the Farmer's Almanac or the dictionary. That obviously is the other side of the coin. But it has, when you think about it, Congress is also an institution of the people of the United States. It's the people's government, supposedly, and it's quite fitting that the library would be the people's library as well. But mm-hmm. libraries and knowledge are bigger than politicians and political impulses. And
mm-hmm. So when did the people then get the right to use that library?
Well, the people had the right to drop in and browse and look around for quite a while. The use of it by scholars was, there is no clear point where that took place. It was an incremental thing, just like the notion to start collecting at the library all manner of things that are relevant to human knowledge and some people think are irrelevant. That was also an incremental decision and came in part through the various librarians and their qualified staff realizing that the library's very existence and the way that it operated exposed it to many treasures, both books, artwork, things like that that wouldn't commonly come to the view of collectors. And gradually this was determined to be a worthwhile thing to do, and things have sort of progressed from there. Now the library, it's interesting, in the electronic age we've entered, the library was pretty much in the avant-garde there, I think, in putting, trying to get as much things online, get things computerized as quickly as possible. And there are many people who, at the library, including the current librarian, Dr. Billington, who see the library as a kind of refuge for knowledge and culture and times, so that when these things are not so much in favor, they will still flourish and reside and flourish at the Library of Congress, and then in later ages, when this, if this comes back, there'll be, still be this wonderful resource of language and all the things that go with it. And I, you know, you, there are other libraries in the past that have, the Alexandrian Library and others, that have performed the same function for civilization ever since there's been the written word.
Well, that's all the time we have. I thank our guest, James Conaway, author of America's Library, The Story of the Library of Congress, published by Yale University Press.
The memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from